Good evening. My name's Rob. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 26th, 2007. I think I said that right. I have a home group. It's the Riverside Wednesday night meeting. You're all invited. And I have a sponsor, the tall gentleman who you just met. I don't think you just met him, though. It's an honor to be up here for a lot of different reasons. Congratulations to Glenn. And thank you, Stephen, for the warm welcome back. You can bring your expectations back down now. Stephen was actually one of the first people I met when I came in here. He is the same now as he was then. He was out there with his hand out immediately. I think he gave me a ride home from like my second AA meeting ever at 3333. I don't know if he remembers that or not, but I do. Bill, thank you for asking me to speak. It is an honor. I try to get my head wrapped around 27 years, and it just goes 27 years. Like, that is a really, really long time. I know there's people that have more than 27 years, but, you know, that's my brain's not going up that high. I was 6 years old when Bill got sober, okay? there's people in here that weren't born when Bill got sober. In fact, when Bill got sober, a gallon of gas cost $1.20. When Bill got sober, the number one movie in America was Back to the Future 1. And when Bill got sober, the number one song on the Billboard Top 100 was Like a Virgin by Madonna. I couldn't help it. No, seriously. I'm not going to say that Bill saved my life, but I will say that Bill, as my sponsor, acting as a conduit for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to transmit the message of hope to me, did save my life. And I'll be forever grateful. Damn, this podium gets you. But I had no idea that that was going to happen when I walked in here. I mean, I was 29 years old, and I thought my life was over. I mean, 29 is like, that's like middle-aged by YPG standards. But I thought I was done. I had no idea that it hadn't started yet, that I was at the beginning. You know, I figured out later that, you know, we call them birthdays because for a lot of reasons, like, that was when I was born. I mean, everything else that happened up until that point was, like, just the crap I had to go through to get here. It was the day after Christmas. As Bill likes to say, the day after baby Jesus' birthday. And that was a rough Christmas. That was the worst Christmas ever and the best Christmas ever. And a lot of you know exactly what I mean. The day before, on Christmas Day, I woke up that morning and I went to the sink of the house that I was living in Gainesville, and I was hunched over the sink and drinking, I think it was tequila out of a plastic bottle. And I was waiting for my ride to pick me up to bring me back to Tampa to try and see if this program would work for me. I have a hard time when I tell my story with the what happened and what it was like, because I always feel like I'm an unreliable witness. If you want to know how I ended up at that sink, you know, in such a sad state, I don't think I can reliably tell you how that happened. I don't know how it started. I can tell you when it started, and it wasn't in my childhood. I've heard a lot of speakers say that they felt different, you know, from as far back as they can remember, and I'm pretty sure that that's not the case with me. Like, I think I was a happy kid. I'm pretty sure I was a weird kid, but I didn't know it. Like, I thought I was perfectly normal. We were at my grandmother's house a couple of weeks ago. She had all these pictures out, and in every picture, everybody else, you know, it's like, and I'm doing something, you know, I was like, man, I was a messed up kid. I was a spaz. But it didn't matter because I didn't know it. Like, I didn't feel any different. Like, I was smart. You know, I was good at sport. I did good in school all the way up. I can tell you when it changed. It changed for me my junior year in high school. Absolutely nothing happened to me or around me that created that change. The only thing that I can possibly come up with is that strand of DNA that makes me an alcoholic was activated. Because for no reason whatsoever, I developed resentments against everything. I developed it against my family. my two sisters who were my best friends, my parents, school, society, religion. I mean, God, it just, the concentric circles of resentment just got bigger and bigger with zero foundation for why they existed. It was when I started to exhibit alcoholic behaviors, just complete self-centeredness. And it was when I really, I didn't know this was what I was feeling at the time. Like Stephen said, I didn't have these words, but it was when I seriously began to feel isolated, separated. I mean, absolutely disconnected from everything around me. I developed a huge resentment against the spirituality that my parents had raised me with. And it wasn't like, I was never like chased around by nuns with rulers. Like, we were in like a little Presbyterian church. Like, we went on, we had barbecues and went on ski trips. You know, like, there's nothing scary about this. They taught God is love and treat your neighbor the way you want to be treated. And you know, it was taught with love and compassion, not like fear or damnation. But it didn't matter. I felt a disconnect from, I guess, what I had previously felt like was a higher power. And I thought that he did it. And therefore, I was resentful. I mean, at the end of the day, when you're an overthinking teenager, what do? You look up. And that's where my resentment ultimately landed. I was lucky. I had done well enough up until that point that I was able to graduate, you know, despite doing everything I could to the opposite. I did manage to graduate, and I was even accepted into the University of Florida down here. And I'm pretty sure at the time that I was fairly unaware of most of this. I think I thought I was going through like normal teenage, angsty, rebellious. Pretty sure that's not what it was. And I decided, all right, well, I'll go to the University of Florida because that'll be away from a lot of the sources of resentment that I seem to have developed. And I got there and I found out really, really quickly that it had nothing to do with where I had been or who I had been around. That the truth was much closer to the fact that I had developed this fundamental inability to relate to my environment. I was kicked out of school in like two semesters. I mean, it took no time. I went to no class. I couldn't understand how you could go to class. I was in the search for something that would make me feel different. So when I saw other people like putting a book in a backpack, I was like, why are you doing that? We need to go feel different. And they didn't, no, I got class, man. Whatever, I'm going to be in the woods. I'm going to go smoke some pot. Like, I didn't gravitate to drinking at first just because I'm pretty sure I thought alcohol was like really pedestrian. Like, they sell it in stores. Like, how good can that really be? Like, frat guys drink. I'm not doing that. So, you know, I tried a bunch of other things first, and you know, it might have gotten me by to the point that I didn't really go crazy for a while, but it never scratched the itch that alcohol would. And it started out so innocuously. It was, I think I had a roommate, and he was a total normal kid, like did good in school. He was nothing weird about this kid. And he liked occasionally, not even every night, occasionally he liked to have a couple of beers and like watch a baseball game. And at some point I decided I would join him. And he didn't mind at all because it was somebody to have a couple of beers with and watch a baseball game. But it was very, very quickly after that every night I had two or three beers, and I didn't care if there was a baseball game on or not. I didn't know what was happening is that I was getting like a slow drip of the ease and comfort that the Big Book talks about. And it very, very quickly became that the only time that I felt okay was at night when I was drinking. And that was as far as my association got with it. You know, normal progression sets in. Two beers don't last long, you know, a few months down the road. And real quickly, it was, you know, it was 10 beers. It was 20 beers. And while it was a temporary solution to what I was feeling at the time, I still couldn't function sober. I just couldn't stand being in my own skin sober. So I, there was no way I could. I never held down a job the entire time. I think the longest I had a job was for like 6 months, and that was like at a bar where they let me drink. But other than that, you know, I'd have a job for like 2 weeks, and then it was out. And the only way I got by was my grandmother was just the, oh my God, you guys would have loved her. She was the most perfect enabler ever. She would just like send me a check for like a few hundred dollars like every couple of weeks. And that was enough to like pay rent and drink. And that's all I did. And I wish that I could tell you that I'm getting to, like, the exciting part of the story, but there isn't one. There's no gunfights. There's no car chases. There's no nothing. I was amazingly lucky, if you want to call it that, in the types of consequences. I've never been arrested. I never got a DUI. I never even got, like, an open container ticket. Like, I have a clean bill of health, which today I'm extremely grateful for. But I also like to mention that just because there was a time where I worried that having a DUI was some kind of prerequisite for qualifying for this program, and that it's not. I always feel compelled when I speak to sort of imagine that I'm in the room. And by that, I mean, before I got sober, about a month before I got sober, I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a YPG meeting. And I didn't identify myself. I didn't introduce myself. I don't think most people knew I was here. They might have been like, wow, there was a really sick-looking kid in the back tonight. But that would have been it. Like, I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't let them know that I was on the fence, that I was thinking about this thing. So, you know, I really feel compelled to pretend like Rob's sitting back there someplace. And you don't have to have a DUI. It's not a requirement. I got really, really lucky. Most of my consequences were physical. I got to the point where I was 60 pounds lighter than I am now. I was so pale. My fiance likes to say I was like one of those see-through fish, like on the Discovery Channel. Like, you could, like, watch my organs work. I was really pale. There are people in this room that were at the first meeting I ever went to, and they'll hopefully not show you any pictures. But I got really lucky in that they were things that I can heal from. I still have a good little shake that I probably won't ever lose. I think that's just like central nervous damage. But as stubborn as I am, and I'm still pretty stubborn, I was even more stubborn when I was drinking. And the only way that I was going to ever think that there was a possibility that this program could work for me were if I were given rock solid empirical evidence to that effect. And it's amazing, but that's exactly what I was given. My younger sister shares this affliction with all of us. Most of you know her name's Suzanne. The difference between the way that my disease worked and hers did, and I don't intend to tell a bunch of her story, but it's kind of impossible to not tell a little bit of it, is whereas my alcoholism was like a slow descent, just this being the graph where things get worse, hers was like a cannonball run down a mountain, like hitting every tree and rock. I mean, where I didn't get arrested for anything, Suzanne got caught doing everything. I mean, she couldn't get away with anything. That was good for both of us because in the end, she found her way to a treatment program eventually that introduced her to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it worked with her. And when she got out of that treatment program, she stuck right with that Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the course of my last year of drinking, as Bill was mentioning, we like passed each other on elevators going in the opposite direction. The consequences, especially physically for me, like I was on a real, real short timeline with, you know, how long I had left. And I was just getting sicker and sicker, and it was impossible for me to not notice that she was getting better and better. The last car that I had, like a drunk friend of mine had wrecked, so I had no car, and she like had just gotten a car because she was working the steps and had like cleaned up her license, and you know, all of a sudden she can drive again and I can't, and I've been unemployable for over 10 years and she just got a job. You know, I have never been able to succeed in school, and she's like out getting a medical license. It just baffled me. Like, it was impossible for me to not notice this sort of inverse effect. And it was amazing because she was never the type to come and bash me over the head with it, which is exactly what she must have wanted to do. Like, drive up to Gainesville and be like, you know, you're coming to a meeting. This is what you need. She never did that. She practiced the principles in all of her affairs and let the attraction do the work. And guess what? It does. It works. Because I saw her get physically, she went from being a sick person to a healthy person. What was amazing for me is I didn't know what that healthy person looked like until she grew into it. And all of a sudden, it's right there and it's in my face. So a month before the Christmas that I got sober, I came home for Thanksgiving, and she brought me to a meeting of YPG, no less. And I didn't identify myself, but my ears were open. Not open enough that I remember anything anybody said, but it was definitely a time I know that that message was planted in my head. Like, it was the first time that I ever had seen anything that even resembled hope in such a long time. In the time that I've been sober, I've heard a good number of speakers, and I've heard a lot of people share in meetings. And if there was one quality that I would have to say seems to me to be the most universal, it's loneliness. It's isolation. Like, the circumstances can be all different. Loneliness seems to be something I hear a lot of people talk about. And that was what was killing me, ultimately. Like, emotionally, was just that crushing loneliness. And I had long since given up the idea that there was hope, that there was a way out of this. And I didn't totally get that message that night, but there was like a tiny little seed was planted in there. We came home, and this part always gets me. I had to go back. Let me change that. I didn't have to. I'm thinking that I need to go back to Gainesville because that's where I live, and that's especially where I do my drinking. And I didn't want to. For the first time, I remember like having the aware cognitive thought, like, I don't want to go back there. I know what's there. Like, misery. Like, me in my little room on the bed with the sheets that have not been washed in years, you know, and booze, and that's it. And I said that to my sister, and she said something that absolutely, like, shook the foundations of the way I thought Earth existed. She said, "You don't have to." That was an incredibly shocking thought to me. It had never been something that had even occurred to me. Like, in alcoholism, it always had such a grip on me that it was just a permanent, this is the way you have to go. You have to come home and you have to drink. This is what must happen. When she said, "You don't have to," it was the first time that I felt like I had anything resembling freedom. And that sounded really good, because I did not want to go back and drink some more. And if you're new here tonight, or if you're me then sitting back there, let me remind you, you don't have to go back out there. People said that once I came into the program, I heard that all the time. If you don't want to drink again, you don't ever have to. It's not a requirement. I made the bad decision and I went back to Gainesville. I sat up there for a couple of weeks and I drank. I had asked her if she would send me a big book, and she sent me one, even though it was a small one. And I would sit there in my bed with the sheets that hadn't been washed in years, and I would read that big book and drink. I don't recommend that. No, don't do that. I would sat there and I read, but it worked. I mean, I read more about alcoholism and the doctor's opinion, and I remember thinking that this is the never-ending story. Like, why am I in this book? It was like someone had telepathically gone through all the thoughts that I had had for the past 10 years and had, like, written them down. I mean, it scared the hell out of me. But it worked. And I eventually made a phone call back here to Tampa, and I was like, I want to come home. I just can't do this anymore. And she was like, oh, I'm going on a camping trip, like, right around Christmas with people from YPG, and I'll come pick you up. And I'm like, okay. And so she met me right after my sink episode and picked me up. And I must have smelled real bad, but she didn't say a word. And she brought me back here for what would be the worst Christmas ever. They gave me a little bit to eat. And my parents sat me down on the couch and they're like, we're going to do Christmas now. And they start handing out presents. And everyone has presents, even me. And I can tell you, I deserved no presents. But everyone is opening these presents. And I have this disturbing and just sad awakening when I think, none of these presents are from me. It sounds really simple, but at the time, it was like the illustration right there in front of me of just what a piece of ass I had developed into, just how self-centered, at like, I mean, I had just turned into a terrible person. And there was this family, a lot like Stevens, who had just offered me every opportunity to try and improve my lot in life, and I had just thrown it back in their faces. I'd never shown any kind of gratitude whatsoever. And I had the thought, I'm never, ever, ever going to let this happen again. And the next night, I went to my very first meeting as an alcoholic, and it was at the Red Door. And if you haven't ever been to the Red Door, go to the Red Door. It was smoky, and it was tiny, and it was kind of, it smelled bad, but I was all those things. So it was like home. I loved it. And we talked about the first step, and I seriously thought that my sister had like called ahead and been like, I'm bringing my brother, we need to talk about step one. I had no idea, that's not how this works, that you just get what you're there to hear. And somebody at that meeting said, you're the most important person in the room, and I thought, you're crazy. I don't remember a whole lot of what was said. I know Mark gave me my white chip. He's over there. Which scared the hell out of me because there was this big bald guy coming to hug at me. I'm good, man. And I heard Bill talk for the first time. He had his back to me. I don't think he even noticed me. And I heard him speak, and he shared a little bit of his story and how he got there. And my story, our two stories have very little in common. But it was the way he spoke and the way that he expressed himself that I was like, I can communicate with this guy. This guy somehow thinks the way that I think. And I called him that night, and he's been my sponsor ever since. So if I'm out there right now, don't panic. You don't have to go back and get a sponsor. Because if you get a sponsor, all those other little details that you seem to be hearing a lot about right now tend to work themselves out. And having that person there, like Bill, to walk you through some of that stuff is the most life-changing thing that I was ever given the strength to do. So thank you, Bill. Congratulations. And thank you all for putting up with me. Appreciate it.